When we think of the Amazon rainforest, the first thing that comes to mind is usually the trees. But approximately a fifth of the Amazon is covered by fresh water, rivers, lakes, and wetlands. A new study published this month warns that the Amazon's freshwater ecosystems are underprotected and increasingly degraded by human activities. Deforestation, pollution, construction of dams, and overfishing are all on the list of threats. That study was conducted by a team of researchers from the Amazon Environmental Research Institute, UC Santa Barbara, Brazil's National Institute for Space Research, the Nature Conservancy, and Woods Hole Research Center. Leading the study was Dr. Leandro Castello. He's a research associate at the Woods Hole Research Center, and he's been studying the Amazon's freshwater ecosystems for more than a decade. Leandro, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Now, at the core of this whole issue is really an issue of a lack of awareness. I think even my three-year-old right now in his preschool is studying rainforests, and he comes home talking about the monkeys and the trees and deforestation, but they never mention the water. So, I mean, this is a huge area and a critical component of the ecosystem. How big an area are we talking when we talk about the freshwater ecosystems of the Amazon?
That's one of the issues that is, in fact, a problem. There has been so few research in freshwater ecosystems in the Amazon that we don't even have an estimate of total area covered by those ecosystems. The current estimates range between 15% of the area to up to 29%.
So if we put that into hard numbers, I think I saw an estimate that's at least 1 million square kilometers, which comes out to like 250 million acres. I mean, this is a really enormous area.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very diverse. Can you give us a sense of what some of these different ecosystems look like? Obviously, some of it is just rivers, there are lakes, there are wetlands. What do these actually look like?
So based on the current information, we have there are the main river channels, of course. Then there are river floodplains, which there are in the United States, such as the Mississippi. Bogs, marshes, mangrove ecosystems, and as well as high-altitude freshwater ecosystems, such as lakes and bogs.
So that really is a huge diversity of different types of ecosystems to take into account. And you say there's been almost no research on any of them, really.
Well, not quite. Most of the research has been done on the river floodplains, and those are comparatively well-studied. But the remaining ecosystems, many of which are some of the most abundant, those are are poorly studied.
And they're really important parts of the forest as a whole, right? How do these freshwater ecosystems interact with the trees and the terrestrial ecosystems that we tend to think of more as being the rainforest?
In many places, it's even hard to tell which one is which. Most of my work has been on the river floodplains of the main Amazon. And the ecosystems there are called the flooded forest, because when it's rainy season and the waters of the main Amazon raise, entire areas, huge areas of forest are flooded. So in that time, fish actually migrate and live in the middle of a forest. So that's how close the connection between rivers and forest ecosystems in the Amazon is. Of course, in other areas, not like that, but it's equally strong, I think.
I mean, there are some fish that actually are eating the leaves that fall from the trees, right?
The most abundant fishes in the Amazon, they depend on flooded forest. There has been a famous book published 30 years ago called The Fish in the Forest of the Amazon. For some species, you can tell what fruit the fish is eating at a given time of the year by the taste. You know, the taste of the fish reflects the fruits they are eating. And throughout the season and throughout the year, fish eat different fruits and their taste is reflected in their meat. Some of the best fishes are in the Amazon.
And of course, there are humans who have been living there, the Amazonians who have been living there for a very long time and eating these fish and also harvesting plants. Give us a sense of what is the history of the human use of these freshwater ecosystems.
Well, historically, most of the Amazonian population has lived by rivers. Amazonians are actually, in fact, known as water peoples, not forest peoples. A century ago, they used to harvest mostly arapaima, which is a large fish, manatees and turtles. But many of those resources are now overexploited, and now they have to rely on other resources. They also make use a lot of timber, this excellent timber around the river floodplains and the rivers and the riparian zones of rivers in the Amazon. But many of the most valuable tree species in those areas today basically have disappeared.
Well, we'll come back to whether or not those traditional uses are themselves sustainable, but this new study that you've published goes through a whole list of different human impacts on these freshwater ecosystems, and I thought we could just go through one by one and talk about those, one of the top ones being, of course, deforestation, which there's been a lot of research and a lot of attention to the issue of deforestation and how that impacts the terrestrial ecosystems. But how does deforestation affect the freshwater ecosystems?
Well, it's a long story, but primarily by changing the inputs of organic and inorganic matter that go from terrestrial ecosystems to freshwaters. For example, there is fruits and organic matter that fall from the forest directly into the waters that are basically food and sustenance for aquatic biota. But deforestation also changes the amount of water, rainfall, that falls in the forest and drains into aquatic ecosystems. That ultimately changes the hydrology of the river and the entire aquatic ecosystems.
So when we have deforestation, you get more water flowing into the rivers? Is that...
Directly, yes, because less water evaporates back to the atmosphere.
And then that results, do you get an with like muddier rivers, or is it just a matter that the flow rate increases? How does that impact the species living there?
The flow rate increases, but that is not necessarily good because that can change the natural hydrology of the river. But as that water flows from, say, land onto the water, it also carries a lot of sediment with it, and that changes the quality of the water, which then impacts the biota.
Okay, so the next one is pollution. What are some of the sources of pollution in the Amazon? We tend to think of this as a very remote, almost pristine area, and yet you say pollution is one of the top threats to the freshwater ecosystems of the Amazon.
Yes, and perhaps the two most important ones now is mercury contamination. There is, numerous small-scale illegal gold mining activities releasing mercury into the water. Deforestation also changes the land cover and releases natural mercury in the soils into the waters. A number of studies are now showing that mercury concentrates in fish and ultimately on the people eating those fishes. But in the last 10 years or so, there has been a dramatic increase in oil exploration, ironically in the headwaters of the basin, and significant oil spills already have been reported, with oil exploration happening in the headwaters. Oil spills and all the bad things that they carry go down the rivers, contaminating the entire basin.
Now, there's been a lot of international effort towards trying to reduce deforestation. Yeah. In terms of pollution, it's not an issue that I think we've heard a lot about. And you're mentioning, in some cases, illegal activity that's the source of the pollution. How much power or ability does the government of Brazil have to actually regulate that pollution and try to hold parties accountable for that?
The issue of gold mining has been a big issue in the past, and the Brazilian government has taken significant efforts to try to curb it. The problem has been that when they curb the problem in one place, it's only a matter of time until the problem comes up elsewhere. It might have been true that there has been a decrease in gold mining activities in the Brazilian Amazon, and yet there has been an appearance of gold mining exploration in the headwaters in Colombia and Peru and Bolivia, which contaminates the water, and that water drains back to Brazil and eventually to the Atlantic Ocean.
All right, well, on to the next threat, the construction of dams and waterways. I was flabbergasted to read that there are more than 150 hydroelectric dams either in operation or in construction, and hundreds more planned.
Uh-huh.
Where are these all located, and how are they impacting the ecosystems?
Most of the existing dams are in the southeast, in what has been called the arc of deforestation, which is the part where most of the changes in the Amazon have occurred so far. As people move in, they need electricity to do things that we all want to do. And so it's just natural that they construct those dams. For the future, it seems that most of the dams planned, and it's a matter of maybe 5, 10, 20, 30 years in the future, they will be established towards the south and southwest part of the basin. I would highlight that in addition to the large hydroelectric dams, there's a huge number of very small dams constructed in small streams. Just in the headwaters of the Xingu River Basin, for example, one study by one of our colleagues showed there are more than 10,000 such small dams.
10,000?
More than 10,000. The number for the entire basin is, we don't know. The impact of those small dams together can be equally or worse than the impact of the large dams.
Are the dams, particularly the large ones, I'm thinking, are they controversial in that area? Or are the local residents just happy to have the electricity, as you say?
I think it's hard to generalize. And I think there are senses that is both good and bad. It's something that is necessary. As people move in, they need electricity to have lives like most people have elsewhere in the world. At the same time, people do realize that there are significant ecological impacts. And then comes the issue of, you know, what do we want? I think most of the argument and discussion with respect to dams in the Amazon lies not so much of whether there is a need for dams or not, but how they can be developed and implemented so as to maximize social benefits and minimize ecological impacts.
Do you feel like those projects perhaps benefit from some of what we've learned here in North America, say with salmon fisheries and dams, how to try to get those two coexisting? Are there lessons that we've learned from those experiences?
They have been trying to incorporate those lessons, but I'm skeptical about the results.
All right, and that leads us to the over-harvesting of plant and animal species. And let's actually start with the plants. What kind of plants are actually being harvested from freshwater ecosystems in the Amazon?
High-valuable timber. Timber to construct houses and furniture, mostly, I think. There's some exceptional timber in the Amazon, including wood that is so hard and heavy that it actually sinks. Those are command the highest prices in the market and, of course, are under great pressure.
And then we get to the animals, and this is mostly an issue of fishing, as you referred to earlier. There used to be some use of marine mammal populations as well, but primarily now I guess we're talking about the use of fishing resources at this point, right?
There has been significant changes. A century ago, fisheries in the Amazon were dominated by three main species groups: manatees, freshwater manatees, turtles of various species, and the arapaima, which is a giant fish of the Amazon. Together, these species possessed a mean average length of body of about 2 meters in length. That would be 6 feet long. Today, all those species are considered to be endangered, and fishermen are targeting mostly much smaller fish species, so that the average size of fish in the market is about 70 centimeters length, which is about 2 feet.
Wow, that's a really huge difference.
Right, right. Which I think it's noticed by people in the region and ultimately denotes a process of change and degradation of the aquatic resources.
Now, these stocks that have become overfished, are they primarily, is the primary pressure essentially sustenance fishing by the native populations? Or is this actually at this point a commercial fishery that's exporting fish out of the Amazon basin?
It's hard to tell what is sustenance and what is commercial. There are exclusive commercial fisheries, which fishermen, you know, fish and just for sale. But then there are the small-scale fishermen who fish on a daily basis to eat and to sell the excedent, the remaining of the catch. So if you ask them, they all say it's for sustenance.
Now, you've been, in your work in the Amazon, really trying to involve fishermen and their communities. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the use of what you call barefoot ecologists in trying to assess the state of these fish populations.
So most of my research has been on the arapaima. The arapaima is a fish that grows to 6 feet in length and 400 pounds in weight. And it has an absolute delicious flesh.
What does it taste like? Can you compare it to any fish that we might know better around here?
Well, for example, the meat is so hard that it's almost like chicken, not so much like fish. You actually have to cut it with a knife. The taste, I don't think I can compare it to anything that is not it. So the Arapaima commands had the highest prices in the market, and it's obviously a huge fish. So the fishermen have a lot of incentive to try to catch it. You catch one or two, and you're basically done for the whole week.
It's kind of like the tuna fishery, where you get one really big tuna.
Oh, yes, of course.
High price, and you're done. You don't have to catch a whole lot of them.
Of course. But Arapaima are also unique that they are obligate air breathers. This fish will actually drown if it is not able to surface to breathe every 5 to 15 minutes. You know, so because of the particularities of this species, the fishery has used to be the most important fishery in the Amazon, and today is considered to be widely overexploited and even in danger with extinction. So our research on the ecology of Arapaima and with the fishermen, we managed to develop a method that allows fishermen to count, to make population censuses of Arapaima in the lakes. Fishermen go to the lakes and they count just like you and I would go to a field and count cows.
So this is made possible purely by the fact that this fish has to come to the surface. Obviously, that's always one of the biggest challenges with fisheries assessments, is that you can't see the fish. So you've got a lucky case here where you can actually see the fish from the surface.
Well, yes, in principle, but the fish will, for someone that is not used to it, the fish will surface and the person will not see because it's so fast. It's maybe a tenth of a second. So the experienced fishermen, they learn to recognize that, you know, when the fish come out to breathe, they're not all the same. Some are fatter, some are slimmer, some are bigger, some are darker, some are reddish.
That was going to be my next question, is how do you not count the same fish over and over?
There is, of course, a small error. There is an error associated with those counts, but our studies are revealing that that error is relatively small. And you have to consider that the fishermen harvest this fish primarily by the use of harpoons. So I imagine a fisherman over, a 10 years of profession, he's in the water looking for the fish, and he sees the fish come out to breathe and throws the harpoon. He does that, say, 1,000 times. He learns to recognize the images of the fish with the fish that he actually got in the harpoon. So over time, they develop the skill to really tell apart how the fishes are like.
So when you're starting to train these fishermen to actually collect essentially fisheries data, assessment data, how much are you relying on what they already know, this knowledge and wisdom that they've accrued simply by being a fisherman, and how much of it is new knowledge that you're trying to impart to them?
I don't think I try to impart any knowledge on them, but mostly we try to work together to develop new knowledge to solve the problem of overexploitation. You see, fisheries in the Amazon, if you compare them to the ones in the United States, the one characteristic is that there is no participation of government. The presence of the government in Brazil is very small. So fishermen, if they want to overcome a problem of overexploitation of fisheries management, they pretty much have to do it on their own. So we work with fishermen in that they would use this skill to count their Arapaima, to make, you know, annual population assessments, and use that information to determine a fishing quota, just like they use here in Cape Cod, for example.
So because these fishermen are actually doing the counting themselves, do you find that they're fairly receptive to the idea that this stock might be overexploited? Is that something that they already have a sense of, or is that an idea that they're kind of fighting, that threatens what they've been doing and they find hard to accept?
I think it makes all the difference in the world. The fishermen go there and they count based on their own skills. And they know, for example, there are, say, 300 fishes of adult size. They know that if they harvest all 300, they have nothing for the next year. If I were, as a scientist, go there and say, the stock, based on this, you know, scientific method, is of about 300, you should harvest no more than 100 fish this year. At first, they probably would not really trust that my scientific method would estimate there are 300 fishes. Second, why would they really trust me and, face the economic impact of restricting their catches? So when they are involved in management and they participate in the stock assessments, they're much more likely, much more receptive to the idea that they may have to restrict their own harvest.
Now, I know one thing that I found on the Woods Hole Research Center website was saying that the different communities. I mean, the Amazon is an enormous area, and these are very small or relatively small communities that are fishing really within their own small area and their own small community. How do you then, and you're saying there's no role of government really, there can be some benefits, obviously, to a small community regulating itself, but then how do you expand that up to the whole regional or basin level management? Because I'm assuming these populations are not distinct fish populations as well, that they're going between perhaps sure. these different regions and communities.
That's the biggest challenge, I think. I think the Amazon shows a case in which local fishermen have taken the lead in implementing and developing management systems. I feel comfortable in saying that the fishermen are in the Amazon are ahead of government in terms of fisheries management issues. However, there is only so much that they can do. And there are now a large number of small-scale fishing communities doing management, but there's only so far that they can do by themselves. And there's now a role for government to come in and say, okay, you've guys done this. Let's implement and let's work at a larger geographical scale and let's start scaling up the work that you have been doing.
Now, Paul Lefebvre, a research associate at Woods Hole Research Center, has created this fabulous map of the Amazon with a slider that shows just a basic map of the Amazon, and then putting over top of it a lot of these different issues we've been talking about, the dams, the waterways, the oil exploration, and then also the reserves that have been instituted largely to deal with the issue of deforestation. And one of the first things that I noticed when I looked at the map was that the Amazon looks much more developed than I had expected. The second thing that I noticed was that for all that there are a fairly large number of reserves and they cover a fairly large area, they don't really ever, in most cases, cover a river or a lake or the major wetlands. So is there, as you were saying here, a role for perhaps increasing those reserves? And could that be one way that government could take a little bit more ownership of this overfishing issue and some of the other issues facing the waterways?
Certainly. There is a role. One problem has been that out of the 636, I believe, reserves of some kind that have been established in the Amazon basin, maybe only as much as 10 have considered the aquatic ecosystems in them in their design. So essentially that network of protected areas is there mostly to protect forest and forest biodiversity and now increasingly carbon. There is a room, I think, to expand on protected areas to conserve aquatic ecosystems. But as I said, most of aquatic ecosystems in the Amazon are heavily inhabited by people. So you cannot just take people out to implement those reserves. There is a need to actually work with people to develop sustainable ecosystem management. We have been doing very little in that sense, and there's a lot of work to be done to actually get to the point that where we can say that we have a ecosystem management framework in operation.
You raise again this issue of the awareness that essentially, even though there's all this research and all these reserves, that the aquatic ecosystems are rarely part of that. And I'm curious for yourself, I mean, you're Argentinian born, Brazilian raised. How did you become aware of the aquatic ecosystem issue and how did that become your focus?
I think it was Fritjof Capra who said that scientists see and find what they look for. There's only so much actual discoveries that they do. I was born by the ocean. I grew up always thinking and doing things by the water. I did an oceanography because I wanted to work in aquatic ecosystems. And my first job was 2,000 miles away from the ocean in the middle of the Amazon. And in the Amazon, I started looking to the waters. That's how I could see that there were problems with aquatic ecosystems that people were not looking for. I think historically the Amazon has been dominated by an excellent group of scientists. They were mostly concerned with the forests and terrestrial ecosystems. I think that body of research has led to great advances in conservation, such as, for example, the establishment of the protected areas. But we now have to start paying attention to the aquatic ecosystems that have been, to some extent, marginalized.
the rainforest obviously faces a huge number of challenges still, and we haven't worked out, obviously, how to incorporate the aquatic ecosystems and exactly what the conservation measures are that will work. But you have found some success, at least in incorporating the fishermen and the communities in the fisheries management. And I wonder how transferable you think some of your findings are. There's been a lot of research in the past few years about the success and efficiency of essentially cooperative management styles. I wonder if you think that's something that could be transferred, say, here to the U.S. and improve some of our fisheries management as well.
I'm not an expert on fisheries in the United States, but based on my understanding, I think fisheries in the Amazon and in Latin America in general, they are unique in the sense that they are, the advances in fisheries management are bottom up. They've been driven by social movements led by the fishermen trying to establish and to lead fisheries management. I think fisheries in the Amazon show that fishermen can lead the process of fisheries management. Maybe that's something that could be of use here in the Cape Cod.
That's certainly something we've need to work on here on Cape Cod and around New England and around the country. There's really been a history of tension between fishermen and the scientists and regulators that help to oversee those industries. And obviously, a lot of the research is showing that whether it's in the Amazon or elsewhere, cooperation is a much more successful method. Do you think that it just seems that it's a very different situation, though, when you're dealing with these small communities versus the kind of communities that we have here in the United States? Do you think that's something that could be successful still?
The realities of the fishery systems are certainly different, but the fundamental problems are the same. Maybe there is a role for more active participation of fishermen in management process here in the United States. On the other hand, I think the United States offers a great lesson to Brazil, which is that the state can have a greater role in promoting sustainability.
Dr. Leandro Castello is a research associate at Woods Hole Research Center and the lead author of a new study warning of the threats facing freshwater ecosystems in the Amazon. Leandro, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
You can find links to Leandro's research and the maps that we talked about today on our website, capeandislands.org. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.